please welcome Dr. Paul Chamberlain. Thanks.
Okay, I can grab those if you want. No, okay, that's good. Thanks.
It's the same one you had.
Okay. No, that's interesting. Okay, very good. Well, thank you, Norm, and thank you all for coming. Wow, what a great group here. And I know there's lots of things you could be doing on a Thursday evening other than being here, and you chose to be here, and I really appreciate it. And it's really good to be with you. Good to meet Norm and Matt for the first time, and a couple of others of your staff that I've been able to get to know a little bit tonight. You know, it just sometimes I feel like I should be commending Norm and commending all of you for being real risk takers, because I know what it's like getting a guest speaker in. You don't really know what you got till the person's up there speaking, do you? And then it could well be too late. That's how it is. That's how it is with a guest speaker. I mean, I've been on the other end of it, inviting people to give guest lectures, and you just sometimes things don't go the way you wish they would go. I heard of one guest speaker who was invited in and given exactly 30 minutes to speak. Now, I've been given quite a bit more than that tonight. But this speaker was given 30 minutes to speak. So he got up there and he started in. And 30 minutes came and went, and he carried right on. 45 minutes came and went. He was still going, showed no sign of slowing down. An hour went by, he was still up there. The MC was behind him at this point, wasn't sure what to do. He knew, I need to do something here. He took a piece of paper, wrote with just the two words, "Please stop." And he walked up there and he put it in front of the speaker. Speaker looked at it, threw it down, carried on. 15 more minutes, he was still going. At this point, the MC thought, well, I'm out of options. There's nothing else I can do. So he was back here. He just grabbed his mallet that he used to bring the meeting to order, took it and wound up and threw it at the speaker from back behind. But he was a bad shot. He missed. And it came flipping through and hit a little old lady right in the front row. And she kind of went down, a little bit dazed. People rushed to help her. She sat up and looked around and said, "Hit me again. I can still hear him." Okay. So you see, that's the risk you take when you have guest speakers come in. You never really know what you got until the person's up there. So I actually always feel quite lucky to be invited as a guest speaker. And we'll see. Now, and keep in mind, I haven't been given 30 minutes. I've been given more than 30, just so you know that. But the time I shouldn't actually tell you how many I've been given, because otherwise you might be watching the clock here. Hey, let me just mention, Nora mentioned these books. It's been a real privilege of mine to address a number of issues through books. And as he mentioned, I am involved with Christian apologetics. That's kind of a funny sounding term, isn't it? Christian apologetics. What does it sound like you're doing when you're involved in Christian apologetics? Learning how to say, "I'm sorry, I'm a Christian. I won't let that happen again," or something like that. In other words, it sounds like we're learning how to apologize, saying, "I'm sorry for being a Christian." An interesting thing about that, the word apologize comes from a Greek word, apologia. Some of you may know that, which is an old word. It goes back to thousands of years. One of Plato's dialogues is called the Apology. Anybody here read Plato? Anybody read the Apology? It's really worth reading. It's not even a very long one. On that one, Socrates was holding before 500 of his peers, and he made a defense for himself, and that's what the word apologia meant back then. It meant defense. And so it's a very classical word. It was a word used to describe what a lawyer would do in court to give a speech in defense of his or her client. That's what the word apologia meant, and it's come all the way through to us today with that very same meaning, except that it has another meaning parallel, and to tell you the truth, I'm not really quite sure how this happened. But it's not surprising to me that words can mean more than one definition. You can take almost any word you want. Look it up in the dictionary. It'll have 1, 2, 3, sometimes even 4 different definitions. But often, aren't they related? They're quite similar to each other. Well, in this case, look at the two meanings. One means to say, "I'm sorry, I won't let that happen again." The other one means to give a speech in defense of what you've just done. Really the opposite meaning. Well, and you can be an apologist for just about anything. You could be an apologist for the BC Liberal Party right now. They could probably use one at the moment. Maybe for the BC NDP. I could be an apologist for my university if it came under attack and I decided to speak in defense of it. I could be an apologist for Trinity West University, or you could for this church or anything at all. Or you can be a Christian apologist, which means you speak in defense of Christianity. You somehow give a defense. And that's what it's all about. And I always tell our students, that I think the best way to think of apologetics, Christian apologetics, is just that we're learning to develop our skills in how to communicate the Christian message to the world around us in a way that I always add a few terms here that I find to be helpful. In a way that, number one, I always say is accurate or true. In other words, we take the same message Christians have always been communicating for 2,000 years, and we communicate that same message in a way that's accurate and true, in a way that's relevant or appealing. We bring out the appeal of the message, and that's what we got to learn to do, maybe more than we normally do. And third, in a way that's credible or defensible. And I just think that's a really exciting thing to be involved in. That's what Christian apologetics is all about. Now, as I said, I've had an opportunity to address a number of issues through the books that I've had a chance to write. Norm mentioned this one, Final Wishes. This one came out of a series of debates I was involved in. You know the Member of Parliament, Sven Robinson? You know, some of you know his name. He used to be very active in BC politics. He's not anymore, although he and I have maintained a friendship over the years and had a number of other debates with another person since then. On this issue, the legalization of physician-assisted suicide, now called medical assistance in dying. Really interesting issue to me. My mother had MS for 34 years as I was working with Sven on the issue and others and writing this. And I decided we need a book that lays out both sides on this issue. And so that's what this one does. And it's in the news a lot more now. The first one I wrote, actually, I don't have it with me here. It's called Can We Be Good Without God? I don't have that here. But that arose from a debate I was involved in up at UBC with an atheist professor by the very same name. The title of the debate was exactly that. Can We Be Good Without God? Just raised two questions. Is there such a thing as real objective moral truth? Or is morality purely a relative thing? And interestingly enough, both the atheist and myself both agreed up front. There is such a thing as objective moral truth. It really does exist. Morality is not a purely relative thing. He and I both agreed the difference between what an Adolf Hitler did and Mother Teresa did are not just different by way of preference. One was truly better than the other. So we both agreed with that. But then the second question of the debate was whether or not a theistic foundation is required for objective moral truth. Obviously, he said no, and I said yes to that one, and that's what that book is. You'll see that at the back. Then we have this one here, talking about good and bad without getting ugly. Now, I'm not sure if you could come up with titles like this. I don't. This is what the publisher do. They come up with stuff like this. But the book is all about how to engage others on moral issues of morality and faith. That's what it's all about. How do we do this on these sensitive matters? How do we engage others? For instance, if someone says, you know, you have no right to impose your moral values on somebody else. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Maybe you said that. Maybe you thought that. Or maybe someone said that to you. And it seems like there's a kernel of truth, but what does that really mean? Because what that effectively does is shuts down an entire viewpoint without even having to give a reason of what's wrong with the viewpoint. So we've got a chapter here entitled Thou Shalt Not Impose, and some other chapters like that. This one here, Why People Don't Believe. How many of you have heard the name Richard Dawkins? You know that name? Probably the world's most well-known atheist at the moment. Sam Harris, you know that name? Richard, or Christopher Hitchens is another one, Dr. Daniel Dennett. These are often called the new atheists. And they have argued very strongly that religion, including Christianity, is not simply flawed and mistaken. It's actually, can you finish it? Actually dangerous. It's a force for evil in the world. This book responds to that. Why people don't believe. It's all a response to that very idea, and it's a pretty important issue to deal with. This one here is a brand new one, just came out about a month ago, Why People Stop Believing. Some of you may have noticed what I've noticed, kind of a flood of Christians, including Christian leaders, walking away from Christianity, and in some cases becoming some of its most ardent critics, most adamant critics. That's what this book deals with. It asks that question, why would someone do that, and what are some of the reasons, and how do we engage a person like that? So that's what those books are all about. Our issue today, as you know, is why the reason you all came out here today is the resurrection of Jesus. And you can see the question we have here. Did Jesus rise from the dead? And if so, does it matter? We got two questions there, don't we? And we're going to be dealing with those two plus another one as we go here. But as we say, we're talking about the resurrection, but let me just put a little more fully exactly what we're talking about here. Because when we talk about the resurrection, we're talking about an issue, or a message, really, that Christianity has been bringing to the world for a long time. For 2,000 years, this is what Christians have been telling everywhere you found Christians, right? From the very beginning in the book of Acts, You see it there and right on through till now. And the message is this, that after Jesus, and some of you will know this well, after Jesus was crucified on a Roman cross for blasphemy, God raised Jesus from the dead in confirmation of his radical claims, the claims which had gotten him executed in the first place. That's the message, right? The Christians have been bringing. And some of you will know the story very well. But it's actually not a bad idea to think a little bit about what God Jesus executed in the first place. His claims and his actions got him executed. What were some of the things he claimed? I'll bet you if I was to ask you, some of you would know full well some of the claims that he made. He claimed, for instance, that he and the Father, God, in other words, were one. What does that mean? Well, his audience rightly understood when he said so, he was identifying himself with God. They took that to be a claim, a blasphemous claim. Elsewhere, he called God his own Father. He referred to God as my Father, rather than just our Father or the Father who is my Father, thereby, again, as his audience rightly noted, making himself equal with God. They picked up on that. And never did he clarify and correct, say, no, I didn't mean that. He let those ideas stand. Well, another place, some of you will know this, he pointed to their scriptures and their laws, and he said things like this, I know you've read what it says in there, but I say unto you, and then what did he do? He went ahead and gave them his own fresh interpretation of what those scriptures really meant. That's a pretty gutsy thing to do, and they took it as a blasphemous claim. He also said this, some of you will know this, back in the days of Abraham, your ancestor, remember how he completed that? I am. What's that mean? When I first read that as a kid, I had no clue what that could possibly mean. I thought, somebody hasn't got their grammar correct here. We need to get that. I could fix that one myself, the translation of that. Well, there's a couple things going on here. The first one was, he was claiming to have existed back in the days Abraham was here. And just imagine if you said that to one of your friends. Yeah, 2,000 years ago, I was here then. They'd say, he must mean something different than it sounds like he means. Well, Jesus meant exactly that. But not only that, what's that I am part? When he said I am, you know, some of us know what he was doing. He took that revered name, which was only meant to be applied to God. Remember the story, Exodus, back in Exodus 3, with Moses standing before the burning bush? He asked God, who are you? What is your name? And God said, I am. That's the name of God. And from then on, that was a revered name. Nobody uttered that name. That was the name for God. Jesus uttered it, and he took that name to himself. At that point, his hearers picked up stones right on the spot. They tried to execute him for that one right on the moment. On top of it all, he claimed he could forgive the sins of others. Now, I wonder if we realize just how preposterous that is if it's not true. Think about that. Maybe you got a friend and your friend says, hey, I forgive you. And you say, well, that's great. I appreciate that. It's nice to have a forgiving friend. Then your friend says, I think I'll do something more than that. I'm not just going to forgive you for the things you did wrong against me. I think I'll forgive you for the things you did wrong against all those other people too. I'll forgive you for those too. What would you say? Who do you think you are, God? Okay. Well, that's what Jesus went around doing. As C.S. Lewis said, if he didn't have the right to do it, it was absolute unrivaled silliness and arrogance like you'd never seen before, but that's what he did. But here's what I think may be most powerful of all: Jesus accepted the worship of others. Now again, imagine if you and I did that. You'll recall the early apostles never did that, even though at some point some people tried to bow down to them. When they did bow down to them, what did the other disciples say? Get up. We're mere mortals like you. You don't worship us. Jesus accepted the worship of others. Now, you have to just ask, if someone came up to you and bowed down and worshiped you, what would you say? I'm sure you'd do exactly what those disciples did. You'd say, get up. And if most of us in this room, almost anybody we know, if somebody bowed down to worship, we'd say that. Why did Jesus never once tell people, get up, don't worship me? He let people worship him. He accepted worship. And then the point to make here is, these are the claims which got him executed for blasphemy. But here's the point that we want to get to here tonight. The message of Christianity is found really summed up perfectly in Romans chapter 1, verse 4, where it says, Jesus was declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. That's the purpose, the point of the resurrection. And you have to say, like, in what sense does the resurrection show that? Does the fact that a person came back to life, does that prove he's God? Think about that question. Ali, and I'm sure where Ali is here, but he and I were just talking about that earlier this evening. All by itself, it doesn't show that well, does it? Because how about Lazarus? Jesus brought Lazarus back from the dead. In the Old Testament, a couple of other people came back from the dead. Are they all God? No. How does Jesus' resurrection show that he was God? Because in Romans, Paul says, that's exactly what it is. He was declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. The point is this, and I think it's a really important one for us to get our minds around. The point is this, that the God who was supposedly blasphemed by Jesus' claims and actions, right? The God who was supposedly blasphemed by those did what? Brought him back to life to make the point about as dramatically as anyone ever could that Jesus was right in what he said. And his accusers were wrong. In other words, he was and is who he claimed to be. That's the point of the resurrection. Now, before we go any further, let's just note one other thing about this resurrection. And it is this. It was a resurrection, was not a resuscitation. Have you heard the distinction between those two? This is a distinction I didn't really know until I went off and studied this a little bit more a number of years ago. But in other words, a resuscitation, that's something like Jesus did for Lazarus back in the Gospel of John chapter 11. You remember the brother of Mary and Martha? He had died, and they called him. He came. He waited a few days, but he came. He raised him back to the life he had before. That's a resuscitation. And that's what we see in the rest of the Bible, a couple of other places as well. A resurrection is something different. A resurrection is when you're raised to a new kind of life, sometimes called a resurrection life, eternal life, a life which will never end, a life which is no longer subject to disease, to suffering, to pain, to death, none of that. In other words, it's a resurrection to glory. That's what a resurrection is. What Jesus experienced was not a resuscitation. It was a resurrection. And that's a pretty important point for us. So that raises a number of questions for us. There's really three we're going to deal with tonight. And the first one is this. Why does it matter to us? Why is it important that Jesus rose from the dead? Now, I wonder if I could have us take about 3 minutes, 2 minutes. Can you just turn to somebody around you, maybe four or five or six or whatever? Just can anybody give one idea? Why does it matter if Jesus rose from the dead? And if you're not comfortable participating, just let other people around you talk. You can just sit and listen to what others have to say. But I wouldn't mind hearing what some of you have to say about this one question. And then some of you can shout them back up to us. Why does it matter? Why is it important? The question we have up here. Oh, I guess it's not up there yet. It's supposed to be up there. Why does it matter to us whether or not Jesus rose from the dead? Two, 3 minutes, a couple things. Tell us what you think, okay? Okay, can I have your attention here? What do we think about this? Can anybody give us an idea or two on why it matters to us whether or not Jesus rose from the dead? Anybody? You're welcome to say it, and I can say it back if I need to make it louder. Give us an idea. Give us a reason. Why does it matter? Suddenly the room went quiet. Yeah.
Rise again, this whole thing about believing in Christ and going to church and believing in God's a waste of time.
Okay, it's a waste of time otherwise. Yeah. Good thing I added that last word, otherwise. Okay, it's a waste of time otherwise. Okay, so that's what. Did anybody else say something a little bit like, is it Chi?
Yes.
I mean, it's like Chi said here. Anybody else say something like that? Yeah, how about you, ma'am?
We said the same thing.
Okay, so this is a way to verify because if he wasn't who he said he was, then what are we doing worshiping him? What are we doing following? What are we doing calling ourselves followers of Jesus? That's really what the word Christian means. That's good. Anybody else? Are we saying that she said the whole thing, that everybody covered it all? The very back there, yeah.
We are still
in our sins. Yeah, we still are. That's exactly right. I think there's a particular passage you may be referring to, 1 Corinthians 15. It's a little bit like maybe what she's referring to. That's good. Anybody else? Anything else with men? Anything different? Yes. Okay, excellent. We're going to get to that point. Did you hear what was said here? Conquered death so the rest of us could have eternal life as well. We're going to get there. That's really well put, by the way. You could put that as a heading right there. And having a whole little article underneath that for the church worship folder next week, maybe. Yeah.
Well, he restored what he originally intended.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. I mean, he started things back on a whole new track here. I mean, you have to look at, you look around this world and you say, why are things the way they are? If God is as good and perfect and holy, why is this world the way it is? Well, that's a big question. And there's a lot more answers to this than this, but one of the answers is that's not the way it was ever intended to be. Okay? And so the resurrection is a turning point in history. It really is. It's C.S. Lewis calls it the most pivotal point in all of history. Everything focuses. There's life up to that point, and there's life after that point. And so that's really, these are good answers. I'm happy to go on, but I didn't want to miss out on any pearls of wisdom if anybody's got anything more here. Okay, let me walk through it the way I have it here. Part of what I've said has already been said by you folks here. But the question that I think this is an important question we have to address. And interestingly, I talked to Norm, your pastor, Norm Funk, on the phone about this about a month ago, and we both agreed, let's make sure we cover this as well. Not just reasons to believe it happened, but why does it matter? Well, you might put that question to some people, say, well, why is it important? And someone might say, well, it's a pretty interesting historical fact. I mean, it's an unusual story, that's for sure. Well, that's no doubt about that. The idea of a person rising from the dead, that's more than an unusual story. That's kind of the understatement of the year. That is unusual, no doubt about it. And I guess you could say it's important for that reason. But Christianity has a different answer than this of why Jesus' resurrection to new resurrection life is important for us. And I think we could put it this way in a nutshell. It's important to us because I think, as I've said back here, Jesus' resurrection is important because it becomes the basis for our own hope that once we attach ourselves to Jesus, you know what he does? He can pass on to us the same resurrection life. So that, and here comes the second part of it, the death no longer is the final word for us either. It wasn't the final word for Jesus, and it's no longer the final word for us either. Once we attach ourselves to Jesus, his resurrection becomes the basis for our own hope. See, the Apostle Paul used this imagery of farming for this. Some of you will recall how he did it in 1 Corinthians 15. When he talked about Jesus being raised, he said, and when Jesus was raised, he was the first fruits of our future resurrection. You know what that means? It means that when you see that first bushel of wheat come in, or that first bucket of blueberries coming in from the harvest, I have to say it because I'm from Abbotsford, so I got to have to bring in the blueberries here. But when you see the first bucket coming in, you know what that means, don't you? In the fall, or halfway through the summer, you know that there's a lot. When that first one comes in, you know that means that there's a lot more coming right behind. And the point is, Jesus has been raised from the dead, which means we'll be coming along behind too if we've attached ourselves to Jesus. That's the point. And when you think of it, that really is the message of Easter in a nutshell. And that's why we're talking about it here today. I would put it this to you. There's hardly a greater message that Christianity will bring to the world than this one. Let me put it this other way, a little bit differently, but it's the same point. The resurrection is really so incredible to us because it is the answer to something that is so horrible. And you know what that is? Death. When something is this horrible, it needs something awfully incredible on the other end to be the response to it. Death is horrible. And the question is, what makes it so horrible? Well, I think we know what makes death horrible. And that is, it's final. That's what stings about it. That's why the fact is it is irreversible. And I don't just mean final or irreversible in some relative sense of being more final or more irreversible than something else. No, death is absolutely final, absolutely irreversible. So in other words, when death comes, someone you love is snatched out of your life forever. There's no coming back. That's why it stings. That's why it stinks. That's why we cry. That's why every parent's worst nightmare is the death of one of their children or their spouse. Because, see, when that happens, you know for a fact that when that little child dies, their chair at the table will be empty forever. They're not coming back next week or next month or next year. Their dolls, their toy trucks, their sports equipment will never be touched again. You'll never ever hear them laugh. That's what death does, okay? And I could go on, but it's already getting a little bit morbid here. But here's the precisely where Christianity speaks into the situation. And it tells us something that I find absolutely incredible, fantastic, spellbinding, really. And it is this, that this life, or should we say this death, is not in fact the end. In other words, the irreversible has actually been reversed. What was final has now been de-finalized. It is no longer final, which means, of course, that Christianity is now offering one of the most hopeful ideas in the entire world of ideas. You won't get a more hopeful idea than this. In fact, I find that what Christianity here says is so fantastic, it's so amazing, that some people wonder if this is it just too good to be true. So some critics will just laugh and say, well, that's just pie in the sky. Who wouldn't want to believe that? Well, whenever I hear pie in the sky, when I hear a comment like that, I think to myself, you know what that means? That means even you're admitting it's a phenomenal message. It's a great message, if only it were true. And I guess at that point, I just say, have you checked out the evidence for it? Have you checked out any reasons there are to believe something like this? At least do yourself a favor of looking that over before turning down that kind of an offer. Because the point is, it all rests on Jesus' own resurrection from the dead. Of course, that raises another question. So let's go to the second question of the evening, and that is this. What if Jesus did not rise from the dead? Have you thought about that question? And we've actually even considered it a little bit already. But the question is that we're really putting to ourselves tonight is, have we considered that possibility and what would follow from the fact from it if Jesus did not rise from the dead? Actually, I don't think we need to take a long time on it, because I'll bet most of us already know the answer. If we didn't know it before, we may well have figured it out from what we've just said. But here is where we're getting into something that I actually love about Christianity. And the answer is, in a nutshell, is this. If Jesus did not rise from the dead, then Christianity collapses. It just comes crashing down like a house of cards. In other words, if someone really, truly did discover the bones of Jesus, you know what that would mean? That would mean that Christianity is not merely a bit off, okay, or maybe not quite right. No, what that would mean is that Christianity is simply wrong through and through. As C.S. Lewis put it, here's what he said. Christianity would then turn out to be the biggest fraud, the biggest hoax ever foisted on the human race. And you'd have to ask yourself, if he's not right, can you think of a bigger one? I can't think of a one that would be a bigger hoax if this whole thing turned out to be a hoax. Now, of course, I don't think we're even saying anything new. I don't think Lewis was saying anything new. You even read this in the Bible. Some of you were already, I think, referring to the passage. 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul said, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, remember his words here? Then we who have been following him all these years are of all men most to be pitied. Think about that. We are a pitiable bunch. We should be pitied. That would be the right response for people like us. Why? Why should we be pitied? That's a pretty good question. I think the answer is pretty simple. Because we've been duped. That's what that would mean. In other words, our hope that we have for our in the face of death. How about this? Our comfort at the funerals of the loved ones that we go to. All that comfort, that's all in vain. Paul even says that in there. The hope that you have that you're going to see your loved ones again, that's a false hope. None of that's going to happen again. It's all a sham. Paul's basically saying, walk away. Because the whole thing is worthless if Jesus did not rise from the dead. Our own hope in the face of death is undermined as well. And you see, here I think we may as well add this too. It doesn't really help that much to say, well, yeah, but you know, Christianity still teaches a lot of good ideas. So maybe we should keep on being Christian for those good ideas. I've thought about that a little bit. And I wonder, is that something we should be saying? The problem I have with that is this. You can get good ideas. You can get good moral teachings in a lot of places. You don't really need Christianity for that. In fact, another point, thing I learned from C.S. Lewis, I never thought about this before, but he said this. The moral teachings of Jesus, he is considered worldwide to be a great moral teacher. But ask yourself, how much new is there in Jesus' moral teachings? How much did he give that was actually new? Golden rule, for example, is that new? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you? I mean, that's a great little statement. Is that new? Well, guess what Confucius said 500 years earlier? Do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Pretty well, pretty close. I mean, he negated the thing, okay? Do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Jesus actually said, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. So the obligation is a little higher, what he calls us for. But as Lewis said, the best moral teachers don't normally give us new stuff. He said, it's the quacks that come up with all the new ideas. That's how Lewis put it, okay? The best moral teachers, they remind us of stuff that we've already known, and they have very creative and powerful ways of putting it. That's the point here. It doesn't really seem that we need Christianity just for those ideas. The hope that Christianity offers in the world, or offers the world, in the face of death and despair and hopelessness rests on a historical moment. And I said before, that's what I love about Christianity. This is it. The hope that it offers rests on one moment, the moment that God raised Jesus from the dead to new resurrection life. Now, I don't know what strikes you about this, but to me, this comes across as a pretty gutsy approach for a whole worldview. Because you know what it says? It says this. It says that Christianity is willing to stake its entire message, everything, on a historical moment, on a historical event. In fact, on a miraculous historical event. One is not just a little miracle, but this is a big one. A dead person coming to life again. I mean, we thought there was two things we knew for certain, didn't we? What were they? Death is one. What's the other one? Taxes. We thought we knew those with certainty, okay? And here's Christianity staking its entire message on a historical moment in which a dead person came to life. We need to accept that. And if that didn't happen, the whole thing collapses. And then Christianity stands back and invites the world, historians, philosophers, scientists, all the rest of us, everybody, investigate it. That's what it does. I find that to be a pretty gutsy approach. Because if the point is, Christianity tells the world, if it turns out not to be true, then we ourselves are saying, walk away, the whole thing collapses. 1 Corinthians 15 says that for us. But here's the point. As Mark Clark, you know who Mark Clark is? The pastor of Village Church here in Vancouver. Here's how he put it. It's something he's written up. He said this, when we turn to investigate it, we're going to be faced with the question of all questions. You know what that is? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? And if so, what does it tell us about him, about God, about the world, and about ourselves? And see, here's the deal. If anyone's willing to face that question, I think they're going to find that there's really only two responses to it. Either it's a bad joke, you walk away. What was it, Chi, was your term? It's a waste of time. I need to get that up there, okay? That would add to what I've got here. That's one response. Or what's the other one? It's true. But if it's true, then what? You give your life to it. You reshape your entire way of life, your entire value system, your entire way of doing business around the idea that Jesus really is the one true God of the universe. He's worth following. In other words, God really did raise him from the dead, saying yes to Jesus' claims and no to his accusers. Here again, something from C.S. Lewis. He said this, Christianity, some of you may know this quote, if false is of no importance, if true is of infinite importance, the only thing it cannot be is moderately important. And you can see that, can't you? Okay? So the stakes really are high here. And that leads to the third question of the evening that I want to get to. 3-minute stretch break. How's that sound? And then we'll come back and we're going to get into the third question of the evening.